Small details or big surfaces, tight corners or odd shapes, flat, rounded, textured, or tall. Whatever your next project, there's a spray paint pattern that's just right. Because Rust-Oleum's new Custom Spray 5-in-1 gives you control with 5 different spray patterns. So you can tackle nooks, crannies, edges, and curves without worrying about drips, runs, uneven coverage, or anything else. Custom Spray 5-in-1. Only from Rust-Oleum.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Since 2013, Bombas has donated over 100 million socks, underwear, and T-shirts to those facing homelessness. If we counted those on air, this ad would last over 1,157 days. But if we counted the time it takes to make a donation possible, it would take just a few clicks. Because every time you make a purchase, Bombas donates an item to someone who needs it.
Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/ACAST, code ACAST.
Caught Offside with Andrew Gundling and JJ Devaney.
Oh, yes. Caught Offside from just outside of New York City from an apartment in Brooklyn, New York. Andrew Gundling and JJ Devaney. What's up, brother?
What a weekend, Andrew.
Indeed.
A lot happened.
Sure did. Beginning on Friday at about 9 in the morning.
That's right. I was sworn in as a freeborn man of the USA.
Unbelievable.
Yes. Incredible. I am now a US citizen. My girlfriend said I will have to start talking about we instead of they. I don't have to be... Although I was weeing it up a lot. I would say on our US men's national team coverage.
Always.
I always weed.
Yeah. This is really such a cool thing. I know how long... Genuinely, that you've waited for this to happen, that it's something that you're truly proud of.
Yes.
That it's something that you were, I mean, you didn't want to talk about it on the show even. I mean, no. I've known, obviously, you know, you and I are great friends. We talk all the time off the air. Like, this has been in the works for a while, but you, like, I know you've been nervous about this process, about all of it, about it finally becoming official. I know how much this meant to you. I saw you. There was a bit of a get together Friday night afterwards to celebrate it. And I don't know. I'm not trying to be funny or sappy or whatever. I just felt so happy for you. It was such a cool thing.
It really was. And I did feel pride. And when the judge came into the federal building in the Eastern District courtroom in New York, and I could see my friends to the left of me. And I took the oath. Like, it did mean a lot to me. I mean, I've made this country my home. It was home for a while, at least for my grandparents, my father's parents. They were both naturalized U.S. citizens, and I thought about them as well at that moment. My grandfather barely got over, and he was drafted and then naturalized. And I'm not sure which came first. I would say the draft first, possibly. And I do believe this is a great country, and it's a great country because of the people I met on Friday night, my friends, and the people that are in it. And I think it's a bad idea to look at this. I mean, even the federal, the judge who was swearing us in prior to that gave us a little speech and kind of said, you know, we have our problems, but this is still a great country, and it's a great country because the people who are in it. And I really do believe that. And I'm very proud to be, I'm a proud Irishman and now I'm a proud American as well. I feel like I've added something, you know,
as opposed to having lost your Irishness.
No, I look, it's unlikely to go anywhere, is it really? It's kind of with me forever.
I find it a little suspicious that you haven't immediately developed an American accent. I thought that would change. I thought that would happen quickly.
Don't forget that the Irish community in New York is strong, and it is just as withering and cynical with people who suddenly overnight would take on an accent or any affectation that would divide them from their Irishness. That wouldn't be, I would get destroyed. I was told that on this podcast, I talk like Graham McDowell. Now, Graham McDowell's been in America a lot longer than I have, but Graham McDowell is essentially an Irishman. Hmm. But he just drifts into Americanisms as he speaks. He like...
That has not happened to you. At no moment that I've known you, have you ever suddenly busted out some word in an American accent? You sent me a voicemail the other day, jokingly, in an American accent. I almost couldn't tell that it was you. I thought you were taking some like AI-generated voice. Like, it didn't sound like you. It was unrecognizable. It would be weird. Don't do that.
No, I will never do that. I'll never do that. No, but a very proud day to join you all. We had fun on Friday night. I think
it was amazing. I haven't had too many get home at 2:30 in the morning nights in a while. That was one of them.
Well, when you go to the Irish Haven in Brooklyn, getting home at 2:30 is a win. Let me tell you, I've seen the sun come up in that place. Well, you won't see anything come up in that place if you go outside.
It's very dark.
Ah, it's a great bar, Andrew.
It is.
It's the kind of bar where an informant or a suspected informant will have their cast broken open on a pool table.
Yeah. It's famous, right?
Home of the Departed, yeah.
Yeah. Famous scene in The Departed was filmed there. Yeah. Well, it was great. I couldn't have been happier for you. Friday night was a blast. And we'll have a little bit more on this later in the podcast because you, in the lead up to this, you showed me some of the things that you had to study for the test that you eventually would take to have this all become official. And look, I've obviously lived here my entire life. I learned a lot of things in elementary school that stay with you forever. But I looked at this and I thought, this seems really easy. This seems very easy. So I have also prepared a test that I think is maybe a more important, valid one.
Yes, your test definitely will be more important than what the Department of Homeland Security gave me. I would just say one thing, Andrew. Yours, as an American, your belief that the possible 10 questions you get from 100 on the naturalization test, your belief that that is easy was not shared by many Americans that I put some questions to.
So really?
How many members of the House of Representatives? It's phrased differently, but how many are there?
Just 538.
Well, there's 435 in the House of Representatives.
Oh,
and then
including senators.
No, it's just members of the right. So there.
Oh, interesting.
There was who was the president during World War One?
Woodrow Wilson.
Good. No, well, you're a history guy, so you get that as well. If the president and the vice president are not capable of fulfilling their duties, who becomes the president? Who takes over?
Is it Secretary of State?
No.
Speaker
of the House.
Speaker of the House.
Yeah.
Hmm. Well.
So, right. already
those on the list.
You get 10, you got to get 6 right. We're in trouble, Andrew.
Were those yours? Were those the ones you got?
They're a blur. I got everyone right. Obviously. But my first one was give one reason or cause for the Civil War.
Oh, okay. I would assume slavery was the answer.
Just do that.
Yeah.
Let's
not dance around and get cute here.
Don't get cute. Don't get clever. Do that. And I think Woodrow Wilson was one of mine. And I just remember him because I remember I want to get a picture in my mind of old Woodrow. Mm-hmm. Nerd.
So I would have been in trouble potentially on this test as well. But I'll have some other even more important questions, the kind that I'd be more well suited for later on in the podcast. But JJ, everyone is here today. I mean, obviously everybody's happy about that and feels good for you. And I'm sure you'll get a ton of Reddit mentions and Twitter mentions, and as you should. But everybody is here today because Liverpool and Manchester City met over the weekend in an enormously important Premier League clash between these two rivals of the era. And it ended in, perhaps fittingly, a 1-1 draw at Anfield. And I think
there's a lot to
come from this one.
Yeah, there's so much to come from it. Again, the Monroe was packed. absolutely packed. Drink this era in. These games have been brilliant. They really have. There's the odd dud. There's the, remember the 0-0 at Anfield where Riyad Mahrez blasted his field goal high into the...
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, that was a bit of a dud. But that was coming after a season where they just had some of the most incredible meetings in the Champions League. These games are just... It's a special time. And I would say this, and I hope Manchester City fans don't take this the wrong way. But again, maybe I'm over what fans do and don't take the wrong way. Take it whatever way you want. Liverpool's contribution to the Premier League, the way that they are able to get into City and rattle City is phenomenal. They do it like no other team is capable.
That's not
of
true.
No, no other team gets into them like that. They
look
don't.
Go look up Tottenham's record against Pep.
Conte's record.
I think I think you'd be pretty surprised.
It is pretty good.
I mean, look, Arsenal beat City this year. United have had weird successes in this bad era for the team against
City
over the years.
Like, but it's not.
Well, Liverpool have gone toe-to-toe with them in the league, but they're not the only team that have been able to get at Manchester City.
Don't be Johnny Results, Andrew. They're the only team that's been able to push them in a title race. They're the only team that's been able to rattle them within a game where you can literally watch them get discomforted and crumble. And City don't even really crumble because they'll still create chances. They'll still discomfort the opposition, even an opposition as good as Liverpool. But I guess what I'm trying to say in a very inarticulate way is that I've very much enjoyed these games. And when Klopp goes, I don't care who comes in, whatever quality manager it is, it's not going to be the same. So we've had a great era. This is, you asked me before, where would you put this with like Wenger and Ferguson and you know, those battles? This is right up there. The friendliness, sure. The friendliness is the problem.
That hurts it a little bit because it's not nearly as adversarial.
I spared a thought before we get into the game itself, just on the rivalry. I spared a thought for Arsene Wenger over the past 24 hours. Andrew, when you hear Klopp going on about, well, I think me and Pep are friends and we could be friends afterwards. Maybe we'll play golf together. Maybe we'll hang out. You know, this kind of stuff. I'm paraphrasing, obviously.
Yeah.
And you consider what Wenger had to endure with Fergie. Fergie and him almost spitting in each other's faces right up on the sideline, like two alpha dogs going for it. And then Wenger has to then go through something similar, in fact, worse. With Jose Mourinho.
Yeah.
Where they had that rivalry. And Mourinho basically accused him of being a man who enjoys watching other people do things to each other. He called him a voyeur. Remember how nasty that got?
Yeah.
And what else did he call him? A professional? Oh, a specialist in failure. You know, and...
More fun, though?
It is more fun.
Imagine, like, I mean, don't we love the Tuchel Conte handshakes? Like, isn't that stuff is, you know, that's part of the fun of a great rivalry.
We want the soap opera. We're not really getting it. I mean, we're getting it. The fans on X, on Twitter, on social media, they give the toxic stuff. All right. But that doesn't count.
Manchester City, if we're talking about big clubs in the Premier League, I see venom from fan bases. I see it from Manchester City fans hardly ever.
Venom.
I don't see much of like the what I see from Liverpool, Arsenal, Chelsea, United. I don't see it from Manchester City fans
sweet,
the way I do
precious
from the other clubs.
No. City fans, don't forget City fans' number is so much smaller than everybody
else's.
Sure. That's a fact of it too. But mostly theirs is defensive venom. When, you know, 115 charges are brought up, or the fact that they've bought everything, or like there was a joke going around at the weekend. You know what? Because we've got younger listeners, I'll save them from it. But it was basically about losing your V plates is similar. And if you lose them in a certain fashion, it's similar to how City win their leagues. You can put the rest of that together, I think. Just a lot of... There's a lot of bile thrown towards Manchester City because of what they are. And,
right, they live on the defensive because people want to illegitimize their era. Essentially, is what it comes down to, and so their fan base, they live in a defensive posture.
Sure, but back to the business at hand.
Which, by the way, Trent Alexander-Arnold's comments kind of stoked those flames the other day. Well, I don't know exactly. You and I haven't talked about that.
I didn't enjoy that sentiment.
Our trophies mean more than theirs.
I think they do.
You are one of them. So yeah. I think that you probably would think that.
Well, I mean, I would never say that they're. I credit Manchester City fans with more intelligence than that they think this is all normal and that they got this through any other way than being owned by a state company.
Yes.
A state body. They're more intelligent.
They know when they were bought, they won the lottery.
Right. And what they lean into is that there's a bigger illegitimacy out there. And that's the illegitimacy of the upper classes and the wealth of the top ranking teams in England.
And the only way
to break through that is being owned by an authoritarian, repressive, oil selling state.
And that is where they would ultimately lose me. However, they are right in saying, okay, fine, you want to, like Liverpool, United, you guys want to all say that your titles mean more because you've done it the right way. But like, there is no other way to be a title winning team these days than to have a ton of money. There's no other way to do it. That's it. That's just how this league is now structured, where if you know, people can throw Leicester City at me all they want. Fine. Use the exception as the rule. That's not stuff like that doesn't happen. The only way it can happen is by being a well-moneyed team that you can compete with the heritage of the other great clubs. So yes, the manner in which City have done it, state-owned teams feels yucky to me, especially those of governments that maybe we have some real questions about.
Grotesque, Andrew.
Yeah, but like the idea of, oh, well, you've just bought your trophies. Well, that's the only way. There's no other way for anyone. Like Tottenham didn't really do that. And they're made fun of because they didn't do the things financially that needed to be done to get to that level. Like you have the only way you can do it is to buy them.
Anyway, there was a bloody great game.
I know. So let's go through this. As soon as the game ended, I did my rundown. I was like, I just watched the whole thing. Okay. I enjoyed the hell out of it. I'm in this mode right now. Let me just roll with it. So I just have points down here that we'll go through. Somewhat sequentially, but just to start with Manchester City's goal, it was interesting in the broadcast because they were kind of discussing, sometimes I talk about this where like we always want to find fault with someone. Sometimes you just need to tip your hat. I'm wondering where you fell on this. It seemed like they went to the side of, it's just a great goal. It's just a great goal. But I'm wondering was McAllister not strong enough to allow Nathan Ake to just move him out of the picture? Did Darwin Nunez not recognize that there was an issue there once McAllister was gone and that all the space had opened up? Does Kelleher need to maybe jump on that quicker?
All those things.
Yeah.
All those things. And I think what happened is the great thing about what De Bruyne does is that they're all staring out for the corner kick and he clearly does them with the eyes. He clearly looks across like he's going to whip it. It's going to be an outswinger. And he curls it down the line. The precision, by the way, have you watched that again? The VAR had to check it to make sure it didn't cross out over the line.
Yeah, I know, because it had curl to it. It wasn't just a straight pass.
No, and part of the ball was over the line, but that doesn't matter. It's the whole of the ball. It's a brilliant execution. That's the first thing, right? Mm-hmm. And it skips up at the right time. Kelleher reads it a fraction of a second. In fact, if you see how much Kelleher gets on the ball, if he gets across a bit quicker, he'll save that at the post. But he doesn't read it because of the disguise on it. I think if you're gonna bang on about how tough South American players are, particularly those from Uruguay and from Argentina, you have to say they were pretty bloody soft there. McAllister shouldn't get bullied like that, and I don't think that Nunez is in his own world, and Stone steps across. So for me, it gives City credit for the disguise that they put on the corner kick as well. The delivery as well, using the surface, using how slick the surface was, flicks up there, Stones makes his run. It's a good goal.
Yeah, I mean, that is one of the things.
It's an annoying goal to concede, let me tell you.
Yeah, a quick corner like that, short, like near post.
We've never seen Liverpool do that to anyone.
Taken quickly. Yeah, but like there were mistakes that were made by Liverpool on that could have prevented it. But from an execution standpoint, every part of it on the Manchester City end was just perfect. Like, so I will give them credit for it. While we're talking about the De Bruyne of it all, because he obviously had the assist there. When he was brought off later in the game, he was clearly
angry.
Mad. He was mad, and it was Pep
had to go sit with him.
Pep sat next to him. It still seemed to be a little bit contentious between the two of them. Here's what Pep said about De Bruyne's reaction afterwards. He said, "I'm happy to see that," said Guardiola. "I like it if he's upset. It's good. He's happy now. I knew what we were missing. We missed keeping the ball. After he went off, we did it better. But listen, Kevin, what can I say for Kevin? We need him, and he is important. With Mateo and John Stones and Rodri, we then had the quality to play and keep the ball. We had our chances. They had their chances. We want to keep the ball, but sometimes you can't. But they're the best team I've ever seen in pressing." This idea, JJ, I don't know. Like, I know that this is a pea brain comment by me. I know that it's very simplistic and reductive, but whatever. There's this part of me that has a hard time getting to the place of, when we take our best player off the field, we become better.
Right.
It's just hard for me to understand that. And Pep's a genius. He might be the best manager of my lifetime in this entire sport. And who am I? I'm me. You know, like, look, I'm going to sit here.
Who am I? I'm me.
I'm going to sit here and question Pep Guardiola. And we've done it before. We've done it after countless Champions League matches for them. But this is another one that's just hard for me to understand. Like, I'm going to remove my best player so we can be better.
It's about this. It's not about the game state. It's about the state of De Bruyne's game. And like, he wasn't in the game. Like, Liverpool were on top. There wasn't any ball getting to him. And he's 32 now. This is going to start happening more frequently for a guy with an injury record like his. He wasn't making an impact at that point in the game. So take him off. And I would say some of that frustration was frustration in that he seemed to be signaling that it was hard to make out. Obviously, they were speaking to each other in English, but it kind of felt like De Bruyne said, they weren't getting me the ball. It wasn't a case that I wasn't able to do anything.
Right.
But that they weren't getting me the football. But at the same point, Guardiola, I think he was right to do it. De Bruyne was not in it at that point in the game. So make a change.
Well, I don't know if the change helped. I mean, did it change the game state all that much?
I don't think so.
And rewatch from that portion exactly. But
he got it right with Doku. The minute Doku comes onto the field, City become a different prospect. Not a different prospect, but if you look at what Doku did in his short period on the field, I thought he was dangerous. We'll get to that, I'm sure. De Bruyne, if you think of just like his luck with, for all he's done and for how successful he's been, he has been injured so much. And when he gets the opportunity to come back into the side and play a lot, in a big game being taken out, that's tough to take. But I did not think he was relevant at that point, and Pep made a change. Did it improve them? Probably not, but it's not every change is going to work out like the way you want it to.
There were some controversies in this game. The penalty against Ederson and Manchester City was very much not one of them.
No.
I don't think you were seeing any dissent on that. And look, Nathan Ake certainly did Ederson no favors with that back pass. Yeah. It was very weak, and you know, it immediately put Ederson in danger. But I also will not let the Manchester City goalkeeper off the hook there. Darwin Nunez is running at that ball full speed, headed towards the end line. Like, I think a keeper needs to understand that situation when he can afford to maybe lay off what would be an all or nothing challenge. And I think this is one of those moments. Nunez gets to that ball, it's not like he's immediately in on goal.
Not at all.
Other stuff is going to have to happen.
Right.
So I won't let, you know, Nathan Ake was to blame. Ederson was also very much to blame in that too.
And I think you're and have been consistently of the school that Ederson put in those kind of positions it's bad. If you see him racing from his goal, it doesn't feel good a lot of the time. No, it definitely doesn't feel good for the people he comes in contact with.
No, mostly.
But he ends up getting, I think what he, I don't think it's, it didn't look like a, he jarred or got his studs caught in the ground. It looks as if he's got a dead leg more than anything, a really bad one from the collision. And so that's why he had to come off. So I think he will he'll feel it for a few days, but I wouldn't be shocked if he's playing in City's next game.
Couple other notes on this one. Luis Diaz, what a weird, almost Nunez-esque performance from him. His energy
The best worst performance I've ever seen. No, the worst best performance I've ever seen.
However you want to order those words is fine with me. His energy was unbelievable, especially late in the game.
See him taking on Rodri and then Kyle Walker.
He twists Walker up. I couldn't believe the energy he still had in stoppage time of that game.
I think that energy was driven from the things that went beforehand, trying to make amends, I feel.
Well, maybe. I mean, unfortunately for him, for all that good work that he did from a pace standpoint, from an energy standpoint, from a havoc-wreaking standpoint, he offered nothing in terms of finishing. And we just talked about this a little bit the other day when we were talking about Darwin Nunez and his XG minus goals and how Luis Diaz is kind of right next to him in that category. Neither one of them are very good. It is an issue for him, and it reared its head in this game. He had chances that opened up for him. There were like three right in a quick succession. He couldn't finish any of them. Chris Bascom of the Telegraph wrote, Diaz gave a masterclass in flawed beauty. So much to chastise and admire, bless and curse. The pint was half full each time Diaz terrorized Kyle Walker in a manner to which few can aspire, and half empty when slicing the easiest of chances hopelessly wide.
God, that's lovely. That's some lovely writing there.
Yeah.
If I said that in the podcast, you'd roll your eyes. I was being too poetic.
Easy, JJ. We all respect your ability to spin a word.
That's good. That is very good. Yeah. It's so true. I was watching the game with a fellow countryman, another dual citizen, Milo, and he can't get it out of his head. I think it's Salah plays Diaz through, and he's one on one. And he shanks it to the keeper's left, to the right, like to our right as we watched it.
It was like, wasn't even close.
No.
Yeah, another one.
That for me was his best chance. And I couldn't help but think, and I'm not saying Diaz is a very important player for Liverpool, I think. I couldn't help think of another very important player for Liverpool who I put my house on that's going into the back of the net. Diogo Jota. I just thought of him there because it just felt like the kind of chance that he would have scored. And I've seen a lot of stuff today, a couple of podcast titles, a couple of little things saying how this will cost Liverpool in the long run. And that's the thing we'll look back on. There's another thing we look back on, but I see you've put that at the end and that's probably right. You can't say he had a bad game, but you know, it's all the cliches, isn't it? Fine margins, at the top level of the game, yeah, all this stuff. It's just true. Mind you, I mean, rivaling him for the worst best game you've ever seen was Darwin Nunez, who had a record number of offsides. I'm making that up. I don't know if it's a record or not, but he reminded me of Filippo Inzaghi back in the day, who the joke was that he was born offside. Unbelievable. He must have had like four or five in the first half.
Five, yeah.
Oh, for God's sake.
Yeah.
But anyway, I'm kind of with Milo on that one. So we left the game, both of us. So we're there and we're two Irish people in the bar. And I just knew the way the American Liverpool support in the bar would be.
Which you are now one of.
Which I am now one of, but I knew that the feeling would have been robbery. We've been robbed. And I wouldn't say it was strong robbery. I think it was medium-flavored robbery. There was a couple of people who they're not going to get over the Doku McAllister.
So let's talk together.
We should get to that now.
Let's talk
if we're going to talk about Diaz's misses, then I think that it just follows that we talk about this. So, you know what? Let's put on a neutral pair of glasses. Let's put on Gundling glasses. Gundling eyewear. What did you think?
I thought it was a penalty.
Yeah.
Now, not all legs to the chest are created equal. Like, this was not Nigel de Jong to Xabi Alonso in the World
Cup
final.
It was much more of a gentle caress compared to that.
Like, they're not all the same.
No.
But
they are all penalties.
But in its most basic form, it is still a high boot making contact with another player's chest, which last time I checked is always a foul. And it's hard for me to think of any moments from over the years in a match where something of that vein has happened and it wasn't a foul. I'm reading now from Sky Sports. According to Sky Sports commentator Peter Drury, who could hear the VAR officials discussing the incident, Doku was adjudged to have challenged the ball in a, quote, reasonable position. Sky Sports News understands the reason VAR did not award Liverpool a penalty is because it was deemed that Doku played the ball. When the check was complete, Mike Dean said, quote, he played the ball first, and I'm guessing that they're saying the follow through is a normal coming together. He's very, very fortunate, in my opinion, there, Doku. I don't know. One day, JJ, when I'm in the mood for something like this, someone is going to have to explain to me why there are moments where follow through doesn't matter and yes. other moments where follow through does matter. I don't know anymore. Like here, the follow through was just a normal coming together. We've seen other times when it happens lower on the body and the follow through takes a player. He gets ball first, but then the follow through takes him to a player's shin. Then it's he's gone. It's a red. Well, it's just part of his follow through. So what? That doesn't matter. Sometimes it matters. Sometimes it doesn't. I don't know when. I don't know. And someone who knows more than me has to explain it to me.
But this is what I talk about when I talk about it, like just being so gray and nuanced. Like there was a tackle from Kyle Walker earlier in the game. And I heard howls on the initial tackle. That's a red. That's whatever. Cause his studs were up, but he's gone. He's won the ball. And then the follow through is just so far. Like it's just a natural thing. It's like Jamie Carragher says, your physiology, your body, your foot has to go somewhere.
Sure.
You know, this for me. So when we saw it first, the howls were in the bar were that it was a penalty. I turned to Milo and we kind of just shook our heads. The first shake of the head was we're not going to get this. They're not going to decide the game on this. They want the bar high. We know what they want to do. The Premier League is referee different. I think if that's Spain, France, Belgium, Holland, Luxembourg, that's a penalty. It's not how it's going to be in the Premier League. And your nuance about all butts to the chest are not equal is the defining point for that. Because it's not a chest punch per se. It's a graze. And the ball and the thing that the VAR was, I was reading Dale Johnson, the thing that the VAR kept repeating was that the ball's been played. He's got the ball. So put those two things together and those three things together and they don't want to give a penalty for that. Mm-hmm. But honestly, in the ordinary run of play out the field, that's a foul. Personally, after having slept on it, it's more a penalty than it isn't one. But putting together all the Premier League's high bar, the VAR not wanting to over intervene, the what you said, the nuance about the exact type of foot to the chest that it is, all those things together meant it wasn't a penalty in the game.
Yeah. And by the way, I'm okay with two things. I'm okay with the idea of something that might be a foul in the middle third, you may not want to call that same foul in the box. I'm generally okay with that idea. I'm also okay with the idea that, like, let's be honest, this was a potential title deciding game. A lot still has to happen, but like, this is a potential title decider, just is. And it was a great game. And we were right at the end of stoppage time. I'm also okay with the bar going up a little bit in those situations as well, with regards to like a referee's desire to impact the outcome. But even with me being okay with those two things, I still think a foot to the chest crosses the bar for both of those tests. I just do. Now, yesterday I found out that that's not true. So is it robbery? It's close.
I don't think so.
It's close.
I can't fabricate outrage. I can't pretend that I coming out of that, and there was people that heard me talk about it, so I'm on record. Mm-hmm. I can't pretend I was outraged. I can't just turn it on for the podcast. I reflected on two things at the end of that game. I reflected that Liverpool should have won it through the Luis Diaz chance, that one that we spoke about, and I also reflected how damn lucky they were when Doku hits the post and the ball comes right back into Kelleher's hands.
How about Foden? Kelleher, off Foden, off the bar. It was unbelievable.
How about Kelleher's save? Was it from Foden? Who was it was sent through? I think it was Foden again. And Kelleher comes out and smothers it. Makes another brilliant save. Yeah. By the way,
and Ortega had one on Nunez also. on a ball that was played in, and Nunez
That's
got
right.
a foot
that
on
was,
it, and Ortega swallowed it up with a.
That was a very good save too.
Yeah.
Like, do I think Liverpool should have won the game? Yes. Do I think they didn't win the game specifically down to that decision at the end of the game? No.
Well, can we listen to what Jurgen Klopp said about that decision?
Yeah, Jurgen might quibble with me.
You scored the goal from a penalty. Do you think you should have had another one at the end, the foul on...
Yes, I think so. I think if you just look as a football person at it, then it's a clear penalty. But somebody will explain me the reason why it's not. Or Howard Webb will call us tomorrow and say sorry. So these are the two possible outcomes. And not, both things will not change anything at the result. So... yeah, I'm already over it.
Yeah. So he's done something he's done before, which is his remember when Lovren went over in the, I think it was a cup game, to get a tying penalty against Everton at Anfield about 6 years ago. Lovren pushed, or was a judge to push. He put his hand on Dominic Calvert-Lewin and Calvert-Lewin went over. And it was... I think it was generally seen to be a soft penalty, and Klopp was incensed. And Klopp went to the Sky reporter. What do you think? Do you not think this was a penalty? And the Sky reporter did not give him the very bullish and positive affirmation that yes, Jurgen, it was. And then he goes, yeah. Well, you must not know the game then.
Yeah,
then you must not know. So Klopp, when he is upset about a decision, will go to, and he goes to it there. Anyone who knows football knows that.
Right.
That is one of the great, like, and I'm guilty of using it myself. If you're in an angry exchange with someone, you just don't know the game. Then anyone who's known the game,
that cuts
anyone
deep
who's
too.
Known the game, Bill, they'll know that's a penalty.
Yeah.
So he's gone to that place, and he says he's over it. I'm sure he's not really over it, but don't forget, this is different Klopp now. This is vibes Klopp, like.
No, he's not over it. You could tell it was.
But he's not getting angry in the way that he would have before, because he knows he's on the rundown now. He realizes he's on the wind down towards the end, and I know he wants Liverpool to win trophies. He's, don't get me wrong, he's not phoning any of this in, but he realizes, like, the way he's talking. Have you noticed the way he's talking about games now? Every performance from Luton to Man City is the greatest thing he's ever seen. Like, he's really recognizing probably won't be back at this level again. Not at the Liverpool. He will be back at this level of football. He won't be back at this level of feeling for a club, for what he's built, for legacy, for the future, for his past. He won't be there again. And he's trying to not be the angry man of his middle tenure.
Yeah, that could be. One final note on this one for me. I just wanted to mention maybe my favorite moment of the game. Look, I just love, like, Arsenal are obviously also a part of this title race in a huge way, and we're going to talk about them in 1 minute here. But right now, I still can't help. Liverpool, City, they look like they could very well be the two best teams in the league. And you have that, and then within the midst of that and this really tense matchup, all of a sudden the seas part, and it's Haaland and Van Dijk alone together running towards goal. And it's just like, this is it. Like, this is why you watch. Like, it had such a...
How good was Van Dijk there?
I mean, he handles it perfectly. It's comfort the whole way. He doesn't panic. He doesn't overcommit.
There's one point he's facing his own goal and he's turning over his right shoulder while he's facing his own goal, trying to look behind him as he sprints in the opposite direction. He doesn't fall over. Any normal human being is in a mess on the ground. I thought Van Dijk was imperious.
Yeah, and I just loved that moment. It had a very, like, this might be an obscure reference, but it had a very Mike Trout versus Shohei Ohtani with two outs in the bottom of the ninth of the World Baseball Classic title game feel to it. Like, these two guys, the best defender, the reigning goals champion in the Premier League, like, all of a sudden the stage has put the two of them one-on-one together to maybe decide this thing. Like, I just thought it was a great dramatic moment there. And I thought Van Dijk came out the winner. Haaland, yes, he still got a shot off. And if he had gotten more on it, it could have been more threatening. But considering the circumstances, I thought Van Dijk kind of let Haaland have that there and did really well with him. I just thought it was a cool moment to see,
it was.
All of a sudden it's just, oh wow, it's just them. This is it.
It was, and I can't get out without mentioning Watari Endo. When's the last time Rodri in the Man City midfield have had such a tough time? If you were telling me that Endo would be that good in the center of the park against Manchester City when he was signed, and I remember coming on, was it in, what was his first game? Maybe it was Bournemouth at home, I think. And I thought, what have we done here? Looked completely off the pace. Didn't look comfortable receiving the ball with his back to goal. I was like, he's been brilliant, Andrew. Absolutely brilliant. And he's come to the Premier League at 31. Oh, well, he was 30 when he came. 30 years of age. Mm-hmm. This is his CV. He spent 5 years, and the bulk of his cap, like his appearances, 158, in the Japanese league for Shonan Bellmare. Then he was 2 years at Urawa Red Diamonds. He went to St. Truiden in the Belgian A-League for 2 seasons before going to VfB Stuttgart on loan for, where he'd been there from between loan and permanent from 2019 to 2023. Like, the bulk of his career has been outside the top level. His ability to win tackles, get in, win the ball, start things, break up play. Someone's been sleeping on him. Sorry, someone has been sleeping on this guy from maybe Japan. It was tough to get the analytics on him. Maybe, obviously, someone did in Europe. VfB got the best years of his career. Well, just based on yesterday, even if you didn't watch him at all and you just based it on yesterday, what a signing.
Yeah.
What a signing.
He had a great game. Fantastic. He had a great game. In the end, 1-1, like we said, probably fair. You know, Liverpool had some great chances in this game. By the same token, Foden hit the crossbar. Doku hit the inside of the post. Maybe Liverpool could have had a penalty at the end. It was a great game. It was fun. I think City...
And by the way, for the first 10 minutes, I thought City were going to run away with it.
Well, I thought they had a pretty good first half, generally speaking.
I thought the first 10 to 15 minutes, they were like, this is bad. They're cutting us open, going down the left. They're targeting Gomez. Yeah. I thought it was trouble. Foden looked lively. But Andrew, once Liverpool equalize, City are rattled. And that's what I'm talking about. Nobody in-game rattles them like Liverpool do.
You're going to put that on your tombstone, aren't you? I don't know if it's entirely true.
Getting a tattoo.
But it is true. I've seen other teams rattle them. Go look up.
Not like this.
Go. Would you, before the end of the podcast, can you find Tottenham's record against Manchester City?
Aston Villa earlier this season gave them a good rattling.
And Arsenal too.
Yeah.
And we'll see when they meet in 2 weeks, Arsenal and Manchester City.
But our rattling is better than their rattling.
There we go. We finally got to it. We finally got to the Trent of it all. But I do think City will feel okay about this. Going there, getting a point.
They got away with it. Like, they'll be happier with the point, definitely.
Yeah, I think that's probably true. And with that, the team who was probably happiest of all with the point might have been Arsenal, who benefit from this as they now sit atop the table with 10 games to play. That's right. All this focus on Liverpool and Manchester City, but here it is, the Gunners, who are top with 10 to go.
How weird are Brentford, basically?
Well, Brentford are very weird, and they're a really underrated shithouser team.
Oh, they're super shit house.
Oh man, they really are. I mean, I've seen it.
They're weapons grade shit house, actually.
But with regards to Arsenal, I mean, look, we can sit here and debate like who we think the best team in the Premier League is, but on current form, I don't think that there is a debate. I mean, on current form, it's Arsenal. They haven't lost in the league since that weird New Year's Eve defeat at Fulham. And then since then, in the league, it's 8 wins, 0 defeats, 0 draws, only wins. 33 goals for, 4 goals against. Now, they didn't kill Brentford on this day, but generally speaking, they are killing teams. They win this one 2-1 in somewhat controversial fashion, which we'll get to.
Like, compared to the shellackings that they've handed down over the past month, this was by far their worst performance.
Oh yeah, but the bar for that was a series of 5-0s and 6-0s. Like, yeah, right. Yeah, sure. I'm okay with that.
All right,
but like, yeah, I mean, not every game is going to be like that. You're going to have to pull out some narrow, tense wins, and that's exactly what this one was. This was a weird game. Now, before we get into some of the other weirdness elements of it, boy, Kai Havertz. And look, I will say I have been very hard on that guy, even going back to his time at Chelsea. I don't know, even now in this moment, He scored 4 goals and 2 assists in his last 4 Premier League games. He's having a great moment of it. I still don't know how good I think he is. I see Arsenal fans have come around on him, but yeah. Arsenal fans, funny I've seen that. Your tweets, and I know Arsenal fans, and you can lie to yourselves if you want, but none of you were happy with that signing when it was made. Everybody
it was
kind of
$60 million down the toilet.
Right. There's a song about it. But to his credit and to Mikel Arteta's credit, I mean, Arteta, maybe in the beginning of the season when Havertz was really struggling, Arteta was sticking with him and he was saying really nice, positive things about him afterwards. And, you know, you kind of think, oh, maybe it's lip service. This is just, you know, we saw this from Arteta in the documentary. He's really positive with his guys. He builds them up. But maybe it's not because he has stuck with him and he has experimented with him at different spots. He clearly sees that there's something there that is going to be useful to them and they are reaping the benefits now. 4 goals, 2 assists in the last 4 games, including this one, a game winner in a huge moment to go top of the table. They are, I don't know if it's sustainable. Maybe there will be some kind of, you know, reversion to the mean, but right now they're getting something out of Havertz that we haven't seen all that often since he's come to the Premier League.
Yeah, I'd agree with you. I still don't think it was a signing that needed to be made, but like he's proving people wrong at the moment right now. I think the more curious thing is it's just the whole goalkeeper situation at Arsenal. It nearly cost them.
You mean like Ramsdale specifically? You say the goalkeeper situation, you mean Raya and Ramsdale?
Both of them together. Now, it was Ramsdale at the weekend. Although I have to say, the save he made from Ivan Toney was superb. The sure. volley where Toney just gets his head up and slices across it. That's going right in. And would have been one of the goals of the season. And Ramsdale gets up and saves it. But him being like just caught in possession of the ball for Wissa. And then I just think that Arteta has found a way to have 2 goalkeepers who aren't very good on like competing for the number one spot.
I mean, I'd have to look. I know Raya had a rough beginning at Arsenal. Would you say that's true during this stretch where they've just been killing everyone? I don't know that I've seen much from him that would cause me to believe that he's still a problem.
Well, no, of course, when the ball's at the other end. But I'm not convinced by either of them.
This Ramsdale one, I mean, honestly, it was unbelievable. It was one of those moments where you, like, even on the call, I think it was Peter Drury, you kind of scream, like, oh my God, did that really just happen? Knowing what was at stake. And I thought Michael Calley had such a good tweet about it. It's one of the things that I guess you love and hate about this sport. Michael Calley posted on Twitter, "No other sport has remotely football's total imbalance of punishment and reward. An hour of intricate play at the highest level often leads to nothing, but put 1 foot wrong for a second in the wrong place, and there goes everything you did right." It's so true, and it's what's so harsh about this sport. Arsenal could, you know, they pretty much dominated play for the most part throughout the course of this game. They did a lot well. They didn't see a ton of scoring through it, but they played pretty well. But then, like, oh my God, it's tied now. Like on that, on our backup goalkeeper who just held the ball for like a second too long and it's tied. It's this sport will be ruthless in that way. And look, props to Wissa, who somebody had to make that happen. Yeah. He pressured the keeper and got a foot on it. You know, it wasn't just Ramsdale making a mistake. Brentford had to do that.
Sure.
But I mean, boy, that was, I actually found myself feeling bad for Ramsdale. Cause like, imagine if the game ends 1-1 and like it's him, like you can look back on that moment, who knows at the end of the season, but like it'll be a moment you circle. But you know, and that was why I thought it was cool when Havertz wound up scoring the winner. Gabriel, instead of running over to celebrate with Havertz and Ben White and the guys who were responsible for the goal, he ran to the other end of the field to hug Aaron Ramsdale because I think he understood, like, wow, that was a weight off of our keeper's shoulders right there.
It was interesting. If I don't know if you read Jonathan Wilson in The Guardian, his headline on this: Ramsdale's puzzling day raises old questions of Arsenal's title credentials. Gunners almost turned easy win into trauma, but should they be praised for finding a way or pilloried for potential prolificacy, which has just not been a problem lately?
Yeah, that seems really unfair. No, but considering
The stuff he said at the end is, this may be the sort of a goal, a Havertz goal, that reinforces the dream, the sense that it is meant to be. But equally, the lack of composure after conceding, the way they allowed themselves to be rattled, must be a concern. A vital 3 points are a worrying portent of a tendency to panic under pressure. That may depend on whether they go on to win the league. How to judge this game? It's probably too soon to tell.
Ah, I don't know, man. Like,
I'm just Jonathan, putting it out
there. Look, Jonathan Wilson, I've got a lot of time for him. I think he's a really, really smart soccer mind. Were they really rattled? Like, what were the chances that Brentford had in this game? They had a ridiculous goal, like really a ridiculous goal that you won't see again this season. You had Ivan Toney from about 45 yards out, and you had the header from Collins, I think it was.
Yeah.
And Ramsdale made a good save to knock that over the bar. Am I like, was there something else? Did they control play? Are there chances on like, were Arsenal really that rattled? I don't know that I felt that.
I mean, I suppose, how much did Arsenal create? The XG philosophy has Arsenal at 1.3, Brentford at 1.05 XG. So I don't know. Look.
And by the way, I should say too, I think that Trossard missed an opportunity to do what Ivan Toney tried to do. Ramsdale, there was the header off the corner. Ramsdale grabbed it and had an unbelievable outlet to midfield on the throw into Trossard's path. It was like a 55-yard throw from Ramsdale right to Trossard. And Flecken was not expecting it. And go back and look at the replay. He's way out of goal. He never expected the ball. Trossard should have just, I know he's like 40 yards out, 45 yards out. I really think he should have just hit it first time and just gone for it. Flecken was further out, I think, than Ramsdale was on Ivan Toney's opportunity.
Do you know what? It's kind of, our conversation is kind of stupid right now. And I'll just tell you why. And even why Jonathan Wilson's article is kind of stupid. And he even admits it in the end by saying, by the get out clause of what he's put at the end of it, which is, it's probably soon, too soon to tell whether it's prolificacy or whether it's a tendency for, or it shows resiliency, whatever. We're right in the middle of this thing now. You know, we're bang in the middle of what is a title race. And what matters is getting that result, getting things done. And Arsenal have shown us really good form, really good play for the last few weeks. This one wasn't great. Liverpool have had a few games like that where they weren't great.
Of course, they all
great.
Have.
It's great. So I think it's looking forward now. Arsenal got the win. They sit atop the table. They're the ones in the driving seat at the moment. The best thing now to do is look and try and predict how the rest of it's going to go rather than reflect on that game, which they've won.
Lots of key fixtures still remaining. Sunday, March 31st, City and Arsenal face each other. There are still big games for all of these teams between now and the end of the season that will decide this thing ultimately. But it is fun. It is fun right now. It is as much of a three-team race as we have seen in a long time. Arsenal and Liverpool both with 64 points. Arsenal ahead on goal difference and City right behind them on 63 points. All of them have played 28 games. Let's go ahead. We'll take
I was going to say something smart, but you know what? I'll just save it.
Oh, I'm glad you stopped the show to tell us you were going to say something smart. You've now chosen not to say that smart thing and just go with the straight up interruption. Yep. We'll go ahead. We'll take a break. We'll come back. There's still more to get to on the other side. There was a huge game over the weekend as well with regards to the race for the top four. United and Everton got a couple things on that. And some things in the U.S. as well. MLS, a couple U.S. men's thing. And oh, by the way, the W Gold Cup came to a conclusion in San Diego, a far drier one. We will talk about that as well. More Caught Offside still to come.
Normally, being a little extra might be a bit much, but not when it comes to healthcare. That's why UnitedHealthcare's Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, supplement your primary plan so you manage out-of-pocket costs. Learn more at uh1.com.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role. Like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Oh, back now on Caught Offside. JJ, I know you and I don't know that I would consider either of us cinephiles, but I know we do enjoy watching movies. We always, you know, we text always during the Oscars. They, of course, were held last night. Easily the what did they do to accelerate this thing? I mean, normally this thing goes to like, it's like listed till 11:30 and runs till midnight. When I saw commercials where they were like, hey, stay tuned after the Oscars for Abbott, for a special Abbott Elementary. I was like, what are people going to be watching that at 1 a.m?
Yeah.
Who are they kidding? But this thing was done at like 10:25. How did that happen?
Ran through it real, real quick.
Yeah.
I think they cut down. It started earlier, didn't it? I think they cut down the red carpet coverage.
Okay.
Which is probably fine.
Yeah.
Yeah. We don't really need that. I mean, great night if you're Irish, to have a Irishman win Best Actor.
Can I say something about that?
Go on.
I love that he won.
You didn't think he was the best?
I'm not saying that at all.
Oh.
I think he was unbelievable. Yes. In that movie. I thought that movie was incredible. I love that it cleaned up. And I mean, look, people who have listened to this podcast for a long time know you and I were very, very early adopters of Peaky Blinders. So I feel like almost a special attachment to Cillian Murphy winning. No, what I was going to say was, I'm a little embarrassed to say this. Until he began speaking last night for his acceptance speech, I don't think I knew that that's what he actually sounded like. Ah. Has he ever used that? His normal voice in anything he's ever been in?
So early on in his career, his first film was a film in 97, was a film called Disco Pigs. So he would have spoken his own accent in that.
I knew he was Irish, but I just hadn't heard it.
Yeah, because when he's played Scarecrow, he's done an American accent. He's done a Birmingham accent for Peaky Blinders. I guess you're right. The only other time, and you didn't watch it, was Ken Loach's The Wind That Shakes the Barley.
No, not familiar. You're not.
About the Irish Civil War, the Irish War of Independence, the Irish Civil War. Of course you haven't watched it. Heaven forbid you'd engage with my culture as I have with yours, which is now my culture.
That's unfair. I watched the Netflix series. What was it called?
Oh, it was a Rebellion.
Yeah. I watched that.
I did. And I actually didn't watch that. I would like you to watch. I would like you to watch The Wind That Shakes the Barley.
Okay.
I think it's good. It's,
you find it for me where I can stream it and I'll watch it.
Okay, well, we'll set that up afterwards. And I encourage many people to watch it. I think it's very, very good. You wouldn't have had that opportunity. He's corked.
Didn't know he sounded like that.
Cork to the core. Cork. Gurumila Mahigat, at the end was a nice touch, speaking Irish to thank everybody. It was a very proud moment. I thought... just to go to Oppenheimer. So I watched Oppenheimer on Sunday night. I've seen three of the nominated ones. I really wanted to see Zone of Interest, but I haven't got to it yet. So I saw The Holdovers, Killers of the Flower Moon, and Oppenheimer. And I have to say Robert Downey Jr.'s Best Supporting Actor award was thoroughly merited. I thought it was brilliant. I thought Giamatti's role, because it was a more comedic role, probably worked against him with the more serious roles that were up for it. But Paul Giamatti was unbelievable in The Holdovers, which is a lovely film. But I can't argue with Cillian Murphy. He was
incredible.
Oppenheimer is it's very, very good.
And I'm so glad I'm glad Chris Nolan won too. I love every movie. He's one of those directors now who has reached an echelon where, like, if he makes a movie, I trust it. I know I'm going
to
like it.
I know we wanted to get back to the football, but there's one thing about the Oscars I wanted to bring up, and it's always we have to watch an Oscars together because I just know you and I want to see your face when the actors or the presenters are speaking. Cinema gives us a chance to reach out there, to touch people's lives, and in turn for them to come and touch us. You know, that kind of like earnest kind of openness. And I know part of you is going, oh God. But even worse is the acceptance speeches. Like, just name any random person, and then there's someone up there, and they're just like, they're to Chris Nolan for giving me everything and being so generous and so wonderful with your time and so accommodating. I know that what we've done and the work we've done together will live on through the ages forever. You know, this kind of, I know you're slowly dying inside watching that stuff.
I mean, look, I love movies and it's not a conscious decision that I make, but sure, like many people in American culture, in any culture, I do hold up celebrities as like, oh, wow, that, like, I do admire them. But there are moments during the Oscars in particular, I guess any award show, where there's a self-importance that sometimes does start to turn me off a little bit.
Yeah.
That it can become a little bit much. And look, if I won an award, I'd probably would say stuff in my acceptance speech that some people would roll their eyes at too. So I understand this is these people's life's work. It's not their fault that American society has held this thing up to be really worth televising in prime time. And like, by the way, the TV ratings generally reflect it. I mean, it's one of the most watched non-sporting events of the year.
Yeah.
Yeah, like they're not wrong for feeling self-important because we kind of have made them feel that way. But every once in a while, I just become too conscious of it. And it does turn me off. So, I mean, look, we used to have a drop on this show. I wonder, I'll try to find it. Was it Lady Gaga?
Who said
like, it's because of you that I've been able to shine. I don't know. It was just
I've been able to fly. Yeah.
And sometimes like, yeah, that can happen. But I enjoyed it. Look, I enjoy any moment to be reminded of the fact that Nicolas Cage has a Best Actor award.
Unbelievable.
I just love, I always have a brief moment where I'm like, oh yeah, that's right. He did win one.
And in fairness, when he was talking to Paul Giamatti, he was full Cage.
And he's leaned right into it.
You put in a contact lens to make you give
like a soft contact or something
lens to make you your droopy eye. Look like a lazy eye. Would I do that? You're damn right I would.
But yeah, he probably would have soaked it in alcohol.
Oh yeah,
I mean, like he would take it even further. So we love that guy.
Yeah, and Nicolas Cage. It's a reminder now that later today I will go back and I will listen to the Opie and Anthony episode where Jim Norton was on a flight with Nicolas Cage and just wanted to be his friend.
Oh, okay. Can you send that to me? I kind of would want to hear that as well.
Oh, spectacular. Some of the best radio I've ever heard in my life. And Jim Norton's impression of Nicolas Cage is stunning. Stunning.
That sounds good. Let's see. A couple more things, obviously, in the soccer world, which is why we're all here. Tottenham picked a good moment to play one of their best games of the season. Certainly, probably their best half of the season, that's for sure, in the second half. I will say this about Tottenham and Villa. There was a bit of a feistiness to that game.
They hate each other, man.
Yeah, there's not a lot of love there. I don't know how or why that has developed.
I think it started with the
Matty Cash tackle on Bentancourt.
No.
And then I know the admin got involved afterwards for Villa with the post of 3-point lane.
I think it started with Doherty. It goes as far as that. That was such a nasty tackle by Cash, and then Cash did it again to Bentancourt, and it's kind of built up. And then you see McGinn come in, and it's
talk about that. I mean, Jesus Christ.
Yeah.
There was a feistiness to this, but you know, looking at when these two teams met back at Tottenham, and then this one, like this is a very Spurs-centric thing for me to say. Every team can do this to a certain extent. But I do think that what you saw in Tottenham in this game is probably just a truer representation of what they are. Like these teams, when they met back around Thanksgiving in November, go look at the starting 11 for Tottenham. It was, you know, Brian Heal, Lo Celso, Ben Davies, Emerson Royale starting at center back. Bentancourt had just come back and then had to leave early in the game from the Matty Cash tackle. Like, wasn't really the team. And this was, and they looked awesome. I mean, the first half was maybe a little tighter, although I thought Tottenham still did play, felt decent about it going into the halftime. But the second half was an onslaught. I mean,
it was brilliant from Tottenham, and they were so clinical. Now, some of the Villa defending on the Brennan Johnson goal in the lead up to the Brennan Johnson goal was about as bad as you're going
to
see.
Well, that wasn't just defending. That was trying to kind of play through Tottenham's press. And it's just not, I mean, Tottenham pressed really well. They typically do under Ange, but in that moment, I mean, Kulusevski just, if you're going to lose the ball in that spot of the field, you're going to immediately be in danger. So I don't even know how much I blame the defending there. I just think Tottenham's press in that moment was, it just killed Villa. And right away it's 3-on-1. And Son is always going to do the right thing. He played it off to Johnson. I just thought Tottenham looked great. I mean, the ball that Sarr played in and the finish by Madison. Madison's not a striker, but that's a striker's finish. That's like an Olivier Giroud goal.
It was a very good finish, yeah.
I thought it was just a really good version of Spurs in this game. I thought they just played really well.
Yeah, and to take the air out of a team that's been flying high all season is significant, you know? Villa at home. For you see how many empty seats there were by the end of that one?
Well, yeah. I mean, you're down a man.
Yeah, but that's a team that's
you're right,
going
though.
Well.
It was still 2-0, and there were empty seats. The two late goals didn't happen until the 91st and 97th minutes.
And this is a side that there's been the quote-unquote feel-good factor about for a long time. So it's a very good game at a very difficult place to win.
Unai Emery, who hasn't really gotten a foot wrong all season, went with a back five this game, which is not typically what they do. I don't think that helped them. I think that they're, you know, we saw the first time these two teams met, it was the high line-a-thon, where both teams were playing high lines almost at midfield. I was a little surprised that Unai Emery would maybe go with a little bit more of a defensive mindset, try to catch Spurs on the counter, which, you know, they had there are going to be moments when you play against Tottenham where that will work. Like they're with their high line and the way they push fullbacks forward, that's always going to be there. Which brings me to the big concern coming out of this one. When Mickey van de Ven is fit, Tottenham can do that. I mean, you saw the way he tracked back and took down Ollie Watkins. Like his speed, his instincts, like you can play that way when you have that player. He then had to leave the game with a hamstring injury. And I guess this is where we're going to find out just how important Tottenham beating out Bayern Munich to Radu Dragozan is going to be. Because he came on and there wasn't really a drop-off. Tottenham didn't change the way they played, and there weren't really many harrowing moments after that. So we'll find out. I think Van de Ven is being evaluated today for a hamstring. So we'll see. Jesus. Hopefully it's not a long time, because I'm not saying that he's the best player on the team, but I do think – I strongly believe that he's the most important. If they're going to play the way they play, they need a really, really fast center back, and he's the fastest one in the league. So I think he's their most important player. So if he has to go out, Dragozan is going to have a big responsibility. Because
hearing about hamstrings with a player who's that quick. Bad.
Yeah. The McGinn red. Come on, man. I mean, like, it's
pure frustration the way he does it. Like, it's not one of those where he's trying to hurt anyone. He's just trying to kick someone. Do you know what I mean? Like, because it's not like he gets off his feet and you know, it's not nasty in the way that he's off his feet, studs are showing, and he's tramping in on someone. It's not a leg breaker. And he knows who dog he's running across him, so he just leaves a leg in and kicks him up in the air. It's pure frustration, and it's one of those that looks spectacularly kind of aggressive, and it's a red. And he knows
it looked like the Saprissa Kai Wagner union tackle from a couple years ago, and when he just like sent him into orbit. It reminded me a lot of that. I mean,
pure frustration.
And by the way, that's okay. Like, I understand there's a huge emotional element of this game, but there's a way to do it. Ollie Watkins, after he got fouled in the first half, he got hurt, or he didn't get fouled. Van de Ven took it off him in the box. There was no penalty called, and Watkins was clearly frustrated. And like, he did it the right way. They show there was a replay where I forget if it was Udogie or someone, he just body checked him late. And like, he went in kind of with a shoulder. Like that's how you do it.
Shoulder is the way to go there. I think
you can't run at a guy full speed and just kick the hell out of him. Like, no. You just can't do that.
Thankfully.
And it's 2-0 in the 65th minute. You're at home. Yeah. You're still in the game. One goal and it's a game. This is a battle for top four. This isn't like weekends in the park. That guy made a pass at my girlfriend. I'm going to do something about it. Like, come on, man. Like, if I were a Villa fan, I'd be furious with him. And look, I know they love McGinn, and it was funny. They're singing his name after it happened. Yeah. I was like, all right, be proud of him. But like, that's a huge moment there in this race for top four.
He is Scottish, though. You know,
sure. So,
you know, there's an aggression there. Oh, is that a racism? No. I'm leaning into stereotypes of Irish and probably Scottish people as well as a bit fiery, a bit feisty. No, it was just stupid. Pure stupid.
Yeah. But it's a huge 3 points for Spurs. They move within two of Villa for fourth with a game at hand. It should be noted as well. And I should say, too, kind of like telling on myself a little bit, I've said a few times over the last couple months on this show that like maybe we need to kind of get out of the mindset of thinking it's a top four race. Looks like it could be top five with this new coefficient for next year's Champions League. I'm wrong. I mean, they updated the coefficient late last week after the Europa and Conference League matches, and England are the top two are going to get that extra spot. And it's Italy and it's Germany right now. England, the Premier League is third, but the gap widened last week. Now it could still switch. England and Germany are close enough where England could still get that spot for a fifth spot for the Champions League. But right now I mean, it looks like it's going to be Serie A and the Bundesliga that get the extra places. So it's top four. That has to be the mindset. And I apologize because I have been pushing an incorrect narrative on that.
No, typical in an election year, you pushing out fake information.
But here I am, though, making sure that I set the record straight because I'm a man of integrity.
Which won't happen in the election.
One more in the Premier League. Wanted to mention kind of a weird one between United and Everton. I say it's a weird one, but it's super indicative of both team seasons. Like United didn't really play that well and they won. Everton had, they had a lot of chances. They didn't really play well, I would say, either.
No, they didn't. But
the one thing I would say to Everton fans that feel that this is like unfair, we didn't deserve this. The penalties do count. Like you still did dumb things to players in the box. Like that counts. Like that's not a, you don't get away with that.
I mean, it was so frustrating. Everton actually moved the ball into the United final third pretty well, only to finish, or not finish rather, with like a shot blazing wide or over the bar. Like they have no clue in the final third. Like further into the final third, they have no clue.
It's like there's a ball played in, and there's like no United defender around, and it's Amadou Onana.
That's right.
And Doucouré, and they're like running into each other. It's like Keystone Cops stuff.
They're terrible. They're a bad side, and now a lot of that badness, because they are kind of organized, a bit more organized at the back, although Tarkowski, again, like having a little nibble at Garnacho, and it's 1-0. By the way, what a stat from John Champion on that Bruno Fernandes, the first penalty goal. Prior to Bruno Fernandes' penalty on Saturday, United had the same amount of goals scored as Luton Town.
Who does that say more about? Because I've actually been somewhat impressed with Luton in attack this week.
Luton Town, an example to us all.
Yeah. Look, Klopp called him Barcelona, so I mean.
Well, there you go. By the way, something that comes out of this, Garnacho is now a massive, massive player for United because United are, when they're laboured in attack, when they're struggling as they are because they're, again, not a good side, not a side that has a flowing, passing, attacking strategy or method, except occasionally on the break. Garnacho is massive because he runs at people, draws penalties.
By the way, both of those, to me, no controversy whatsoever.
Not even a little bit. Awful. I've noticed one little thing. I should have saved this probably for things I saw on the internet, but I'm going to wedge it in here now.
Sure.
So have you seen that there's a lot of fan sites, but mostly the most famous one is the Man United alternative commentary, where they just have an AI voice saying funny things about commentating on the game. And I heard John Champion commentate on this chance for this player. And then I heard the player in question being Marcus Rashford. And then I watched the alternative commentary and I thought, actually, this sums up Marcus Rashford probably at United for the last season.
Sexy Bruno looks up, sees the Belfast Bebe on the march and picks him out. Pass, 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 pass. Probably should have passed.
Like, that's in my head from now on every time he gets the ball. Pass, 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 pass. No, probably should have passed.
I enjoyed that. Yeah.
Yeah, that's good. So not a weird game at all, Andrew, even though, again, more misinformation this time on the rundown. Sad.
Yeah. I said kind of a weird one, but it actually wasn't really that weird. While you mentioned Luton, I should say what a finish to that one. Poor Crystal Palace.
Oh my God,
the number of points the Crystal Palace have given away from winning positions. I saw some, I think it was on Football Weekly. I was listening. I think they said that if they had kept all their leads this season, they'd be fourth in the table. Now it's unfair because a lot of teams have
and it's not how football works,
right? But but it goes to show that they're not getting battered. Like they lead a lot.
No, and they've got good enough decent players. But I actually want to give credit to Luton. Palace were the better side, should have put the game away before that. But Luton kept passing, kept moving the ball. Andros Townsend comes in, and the cross he puts in for that.
Amazing. Perfect.
It's just a peach and a great little header, and they kept playing right to the end. Great point for Luton. Deserved point.
And I should say about Palace, you know, I don't remember if I've put this guy on that on my team already, but I have my constantly evolving Andrews people.
Oh, who's in that?
Eze. Oh, that guy. That guy could play for me any day of the week. I love that guy. Yeah. He gets on my team whenever he wants.
Bloody good, isn't he?
Big fan.
He's not going to be there next season.
You don't think so? We said that about Wilfried Zaha for about 10 years.
Massive, massive bid from Arsenal incoming.
Oh, that. I'll keep my thoughts to myself. I don't want to offend anyone. Let's see. We'll move out of the Premier League. JJ, go to some American things. Now, I did tease us at the start of the show that you took your quote unquote naturalization test, if you even want to call it that.
Yeah, in the middle of February. And then I was sworn in on Friday. So this is behind me, but okay, we'll do it.
Yeah. I've seen some of the questions and I'm
yeah, and you
I'm
got
dubious.
Some of them wrong.
Well, I mean, who's to say? Who's to say what's right and what's wrong? But I've put together my own of the things that I think are if you're going to, like, it's all good to know the history and things of this country, but if you really are going to assimilate, you need to kind of have a different sort of understanding of the things going on here in the United States, the things that really matter. So I have my own JJ naturalization test that I've prepared here.
Whoa, what do I have to get right to naturalize?
All five.
Good Lord.
Five for five, okay. or you're out. All right, the first one, JJ. In what state is Carhenge located?
Carhenge.
Yeah, it's exactly what it sounds like. It's like Stonehenge except for with cars.
Florida.
No, Nebraska. You're gone.
Oh, wow.
But we'll finish out anyway. JJ, Rebecca Black sang what 2011 hit song?
No clue. No idea. Could
Friday. Friday.
Okay. All right.
It's Friday, gotta get down on Friday.
Let's see. 0-2. Next one, JJ. Immediately after his phone call with Billy Madison, Steve Buscemi puts what on his face?
Don't know. I haven't seen Billy Madison. Never seen it.
Lipstick is the answer. I thought for sure that would be the only one.
I love Steve Buscemi. I'm not a Sandler guy.
Oh.
Yeah. Is that disqualifying? I actually like later. Recent Sandler's all right. But Sandler back then was just... And everyone in school loved him. Loved him. Thought he was hilarious. I could not get with it.
This is taking a turn. Okay, next one.
I'm out. Really out.
JJ, what vegetable does MacGruber shove up his ass to distract soldiers in the hit film MacGruber?
It's celery, isn't it?
That's right. So that one you get.
Yeah.
That one you get.
Hey, listen, when it comes to that area, I don't forget things.
That. All right. And finally, who popularized the phrase, catch me outside, how about that?
Catch me outside, how about that?
Catch you outside?
Oh, she became a rapper, didn't she? Oh God! Oh God! It's not bad baby.
That's right. You are such a weird guy. You get the celery and bad baby. You know what? That's good enough for me. Those are the two that I really wanted you to get. You're in. You're back in. You can handle American.
Two shining. Oh, God.
You did it. I'm proud of you. All right. Well, that's very nice. And on that note, JJ, let's go now to the U.S. women. They triumph in the W Gold Cup final, 1-0 over Brazil. Although in some ways, you've said this before the show when we were talking about it a little bit, that this was kind of like when we talk about what cup finals can be, this had a little bit of that. It was not wasn't a great game, but I'll say this. Yeah, certainly. But this was kind of, don't you feel like this was sort of Twyla Kilgore's BJ Callahan moment? Like a manager who knows that they're not going to be in charge just a few months from now, but nevertheless has been tasked with trying to win a really important tournament. And she did it. And I think overall, you know, you come out
hey,
of
you
this.
You know what? I'm saying, Emma Hayes, stay where you are. Don't bother.
No, but I think that's something, this is certainly something for Twyla Kilgore's resume and something for her to feel good about, because she did work in some new players to this and they really thrived with those players. Defensively against this Brazilian team, a team that had been scoring a lot of goals in this tournament, the U.S. Yeah, there were some chances, but the U.S. did limit them for the most part. Yeah, I think the U.S. can come out of this all feeling pretty good considering where we were at after that Mexico match. And remember, I said after that, like, okay, like, if you want to improve, like, this is a bad moment here, but like, there's still time. Win this thing now. And they did that. They overcame that adversity from that. They certainly overcame the adversity of an insane Canada match. You know, they went on and they beat a generally difficult Brazilian team. The U.S. needed this. We don't need to go through and tell you a chapter and verse like the state of morale leading into this tournament. And so for them to, even in the midst of that, go out and win themselves the first real trophy that they could, I think that this is... what do they say, JJ? It's certainly something to build on, I think you would have to say.
I don't think it's anything to build on.
No. Interesting.
Because we're waiting for someone to come in who fundamentally questions.
How is seeing like what Jaden Shaw did, or like Sam Coffey, like the work that she, like, these are some right. new faces emerging. Like, how is that not something to build on?
Come here. I'm just trying to annoy you. It is
mission accomplished.
It is good. But what I mean, just the overall sense around this team is like, there's a manager coming in who has been vocal about the fact that she worries about this team and where they've been left behind in the world in terms of creativity. And all this is just like, this is like the, you know, when you go to the movies and you watch the previews, you are okay. Previews. This is kind of a little preview in a way. Oh, trailers. Here's the next. You're waiting for the main feature. And the main feature is what Emma Hayes is going to do with this team and whether she can, well, first of all, whether she'll change her perception of the creativity available to her and what she'll do with it then and how this team is going to set up and be different. All this to me is fine. It's nice. It's good. It's good to win. Good to get ahead. Like, for example, the goal left me a bit cold because it's exactly, it's a big lofted cross from deep. It's physicality more than it is nuance.
But even the way the ball got downfield, like Sam Coffey takes possession, dekes a player out, and then like perfect 60-yard pass into Rodman's path. Like, these are good things.
Yeah, I know. I just, the World Cup has left me in the belief that there's major surgery, not surgery, major overhaul needed for how this program goes forward. And I'm just so curious about what Emma Hayes has got to do. So like, this is great. It's a win and everything. It just doesn't mean that much to me.
With the Olympics, that's got to move you, right?
Olympics is a different thing. Yeah, the Olympics has always been kind of targeted and touted as something very important for the sure. women's program. So yeah, definitely. But this just, it's not moving me. Does that make me less of an American?
Wow, what a day to ask such a question.
I know.
Not after you got celery right. Not after that. I don't question anything about you anymore. you said before like that this is the previews, and that.
It's just glimpses.
Emma Hayes is the feature that we're all here for. Do you have this, kind of a post-Oscars question? I can think, like, do you have trailers of movies that you've seen that were so good that they, like, left an impression on you? I have a few.
Oh, yeah, definitely. Go hit me with yours.
The three that come to mind for me, I'm not a huge Star Wars guy, but I remember the first time I saw the Force Awakens trailer, I was like, oh, my, I'm back in. American Gangster, Denzel Washington. I thought that trailer was spectacular.
Yeah.
And when I saw the trailer for Zero Dark Thirty,
oh my God,
I was almost ready to enlist with the SEALs. I was like, I was so in. That trailer gave me like chills at the end of it.
You wouldn't make it in. You've got ham legs. You can't have hammy legs in the military.
Go pull up after the podcast, go on YouTube, pull up the trailer for Zero Dark Thirty.
Okay, I will.
When was the last time you saw Bin Laden? Oh man, it's a spectacular trailer. Great movie too. I love that movie.
Yeah.
So if this was the trailer, this was a Zero Dark Thirty. I'm feeling pretty good about it.
All right. Okay. I think you're over egging it, but fine. We can disagree. There's other good things to talk about.
Yeah, there
in
are.
America.
Yeah. Well,
how about that ginger young man in East Anglia?
So let's talk about this. We're like a week and a half away from the Nations League semifinal. We're closing out on this awfully quickly here. And it continues. Josh Sargent scoring again over the weekend. And by the way, quietly, how about like in the same league, Haji Wright? He's now up to 13 goals, 5 assists for Coventry City this year in the championship as he scored over the weekend.
Totally been slept on old Haji. He's had a heck of a career.
I mean, all of a sudden, this position that was like this black hole, this position of eternal weakness. I mean, now it's everywhere you turn.
We should talk just again. I didn't see Haji Wright's contributions, but I'm on Sargent watch. Really nice finish on the cross. I think it was for the fourth goal. I mean, Norwich battered Rotherham at home. The ball skips up off the turf. Really, really good finish in under the goalkeeper's body. And then the fifth goal was kind of set up by him in a way, forced a save out of the goalie. And then actually Sarah's finish is brilliant. Wallops the rebound in the top corner. Sargent looks very center forwardy.
Yeah.
In a good way.
He's making this decision really difficult. He really is.
And good.
Oh no, that's what you want.
You want the options.
Yeah.
And I of all the strikers, I think he's got the least fair crack at the whip. He's got the least amount of a good run at it. You know, we've only seen flashes of him.
Well, I mean,
start him in a forward three. He's the central player and have two, like what Greg likes to do, to have the two really mobile guys left and right of him.
And then in addition to that, if we're focusing on the good, Christian Pulisic scoring for AC Milan. Now, a bit of an asterisk.
Oh, complete. It's a poor finish.
Bit of a deflection.
He hits it straight at the only defender that's there in front of him. And it deflects into the net. So
they all count the same.
He's been very, 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 very good is the point. He's having a very good season. That goal, I'm not allowing it.
USMNT only posting after that. With his goal today to open the scoring for AC Milan, Christian Pulisic now has 17 goals/assists in his first season at Milan. He's been directly involved in 14 league goals, 8 goals, 6 assists. That's more than any other season he's had in a top 5 European league. What a signing. It really, I mean, if there were concerns over, okay, he's leaving the Premier League, he's going to AC Milan, is he going to play there? How's he going to acclimate to that? It couldn't have gone better. I mean, it really has been a huge success for him.
Yeah,
might be their player of the season. Although I think Rafael Lau is just great player.
And if anyone wants to hear more about how this has come about, we talked to Nicky Bandini last week about our Italians abroad. So you should listen to that podcast if you haven't already.
And speaking of which,
Italians abroad, Americans in Italy.
Yeah, Americans who are thriving right now in Italy, or not thriving. Talked a little bit about Weah and Musa as well. But Weston McKennie, who was thriving, then dislocated his shoulder. We all got worried about that. Comes back quicker than I think anybody would have thought. And then bang, 2 assists in his first game back. I mean, this guy, his ability to heal is like superhuman. And he continues to produce in big moments for Juve.
One was a nice little slide rule pass in for someone running on, and then the other one was like a chest. He chested the ball down, teed up a volley. Very nice. Here's a stat. 7. This is from OptiJack. 7. Only Kevin De Bruyne with 11 has recorded more assists in all competitions in 2024 than Weston McKennie. 7. He's tied with Teo Hernandez. Jeez. Among players in the top 5 European leagues. Vision.
I like that.
That's all right.
He's made himself. I mean, look, he's been a staple, but if there were going to, it can be a crowded midfield for the U.S. And he has made himself completely undroppable. Forget it. One of the first names on the team sheet. One of those players that has made the decision a little easier. Gio Reyna, JJ.
Oh, for God's sake.
Wasn't even on the Nottingham Forest bench for their 1-0 loss to Brighton over the weekend. He wasn't the previous game, but there was some talk about him having a little bit of a knock. I don't think he was on any injury list for this one. I'd have to go back and check if that has changed since, if there was anything said about it, but I don't think that was the case. And
did Nuno even want him? Like,
I don't know. I don't know why this move was made. It just doesn't, again, we had concerns. They've been validated, and that's unfortunate. And I don't know what this means, certainly for the Nations League coming up or Copa America this summer. I mean, I would imagine he'll be on the team, but if he was going to do something to play his way into Greg's thinking, I mean, look, even in good times, he was kind of on the outskirts of Greg's thinking. these are not good times, and other players are moving up. I mean, look, Luca Della Torre is doing well right now in Spain, and you heard he made comments a couple weeks ago saying that he wants more of the share now of playing time, and he thinks he's earned it. Gio's falling down the pecking line here, and other guys are rising. We focus so much on Gio, I should say maybe that's good that other players are emerging. I mean, you look at Americans abroad week in, week out, and it's just like Sergiño Dest scored over the weekend. Guys are really thriving right now around Europe, American players. It's a really good time. of what's going on, but it's not, it hasn't been for him. And that's unfortunate because we know there's a high ceiling to that player.
Yeah. This is, again, I want to know how this came about. And I have a bad feeling that it was just, okay, we'll take him. Like, and he's shown up and he's just not at the pace of the Premier League. And that's bad.
Yeah. Not good. Not good. So we'll see what that translates into for this upcoming international break. But let's close out now on a few MLS things, JJ. The Union and Sounders looked like they were going to be taking a page out of the U.S. Women Canada book. That field in Chester was a complete joke, as bad or worse than what they tried to play on at Snapdragon in San Diego. And I think smartly, 5 minutes in, they said, we're not doing this. Like, we just watched this the other night with the U.S. women, and this is silliness. And they abandoned the game. I think it's the right decision. It's not even soccer, like when you're playing in those conditions.
No.
But there was still something I wanted to mention out of this. You know, I've been a Jordan Morris guy for a long time. He was on this podcast a long time ago when he was still
still one of the first interviews with him.
Yeah.
He had just been called up by Jurgen Klinsmann, and it was, I mean, everyone was like, what is going on here? This guy was at Stanford, and we had him on. It was cool.
Been a fan for a long time. And then you see stuff like this, and it makes you feel good about being a fan. This was posted on the Sounders Reddit page. It was titled Jordan Morris, Best Dude. Hey, y'all, Union fan here coming in total peace. I'm sure you all know, but I want to briefly mention to you guys how amazing Jordan Morris is. After the washout of the game, Jordan spent 30 minutes talking with my daughter, who is a fellow type 1 diabetic. She's going through a period of being embarrassed about her condition, and he spent a while empathizing and validating her feelings while also telling her how important it is that she not feel that way. He also talked about how he manages the condition and encouraging her to chase her dreams, whatever they are now or evolve into being. He made her year. He was the nicest, most genuine guy. Also important to note, it wouldn't have happened without the Sounders and Union incredible PR teams work together to make the meeting happen. They're incredible people who are incredible at their jobs. Best of luck the rest of the year to you guys, except when you play us. Ha ha. I thought that was really, very nice. I mean, that game was abandoned early. It could have been like a free kind of like, okay, nice. We get to just like go back to our hotel and chill. And like, in those conditions, after that, he stuck around for 30 minutes. That's not a short amount of time to talk to somebody who's dealing with a difficult condition that he can relate to. That is really meaningful stuff. And I mean, everything you hear about him is that he is that guy. And then you hear little stories like this that come out. And, you know, I'm sure he did that stuff not even thinking that, like, this is not for publicity. I think he's a genuine dude, but, you know, we'll give him the publicity because stuff like that is just nice to hear. And I thought that was really cool from him. That's an easy guy to root for. And a lot of Americans, for some reason, don't, whether it's, I don't know, his style of play or that he's in MLS and not in Europe, I don't know. But that guy's got a fan in me for life. I think that he scored big goals for this team. And more importantly, he's a good dude. So I wanted to show him some love for that.
That's lovely.
Thought that was cool.
That's really, really nice. It's nice to hear.
Yeah. Couple other MLS things. Wanted to mention the Portland Timbers coming east. And just a hugely dramatic win at Yankee Stadium.
90+7.
That is just such a crusher for NYCFC, who give up goals in the 85th to equalize and then 97th to win it. They throw away a 1-0 lead. They lose it 2-1 on basically the last touch of the game from Evander. He missed the first couple games with a foot injury for Portland, and he comes back in, and Phil Neville even said he shouldn't be out there. Like, he should have played 60 minutes, but he basically convinced me to stay on. Now, that's risky management, but it paid off because in the 97th, this new big-time signing, Brazilian signing for Portland, comes up big, and it keeps old Phil undefeated in his first three matches, two wins and a draw. And by the way, JJ, they might be about to get even better. As Jonathan Rodriguez, Capacita, appears to be close to finalizing a deal to move to Portland from Club America. He would occupy a DP slot for them. And
that's,
I think,
a massive signing for them.
Huge. And if it happens, suddenly, I mean, look at them up front with Evander, Capacita. Like, all of a sudden, Santi Moreno is kind of just entering his prime now. Antony is in his first full season there. You still have Dairon Asprilla, a guy with multiple 10-goal seasons to his name. I mean, it's one of the deepest attacking units in the league. Could be one of the most fun teams to watch this year. So Phil Neville's been handed some weapons here, and
he better make use of them.
This could be a nice little career revival.
Yeah, but you take it as read that good players will come in and they'll be excellent. He had very good attacking players at Inter Miami and they still got nowhere. So just be aware of that. This is a very good start. I can't suddenly change stream on the appointment of Phil Neville yet.
No, because when you dig in, that's it. I mean, what does this poor guy have to do to win you over?
But what's he done anywhere to win me over? What are you on about? What's he got to do? What's he done anywhere? Inter Miami was a joke. So much of a joke, he was sacked by the Beckham Industrial Complex. His best mate got rid of him. You know? We all know the stories that came out of the England women's manager. Like, there was a lot of stuff that was not very clever, not very tactically astute. Where else has he been that he's done anything?
I'd have to go back and look it up.
Yeah. So there you go. I don't want to hear about it.
One other MLS note from me. My preseason MVP is on the board. Yorgos Giakoumakis put on a show for Atlanta United FC over the weekend. Hat trick.
What a great signing.
I mean, he's been incredible. He's been awesome for them. And you know, the third Atlanta goal in this game, what a terrific goal. You know, you see there's like Twitter handles of when playing it out from the back goes wrong. Like, yeah. We all like to have a laugh at when that stuff happens. What you don't often see, because it's like not as fun, is what happens when it goes right. And Michael Parkhurst, former U.S. international, great MLS player.
And was on this podcast.
Also was on this podcast. That's true. He had a tweet where he highlighted it because it was worth highlighting. When it goes right, this is like, look it up. This is what it's supposed to look like. And Atlanta, in the face of New England Revolution pressure, they're deep, penned back in their own half near their goal, and they're so calm. The passing is composed. They know exactly where to go with it. And then as New England continue to press forward and try to get that ball away in deep in what would be their attacking third, it's one pass that just splits all of them. And then Atlanta are into the midfield and they're gone. And that's it. I mean, you can see there's like 6-7 Revolution players behind the play. This is why teams will continue to pass it out from the back, because when it works, you create these counterattacking situations when they wouldn't ordinarily be there. And Giakoumakis finished it off brilliantly, as he does. But, you know, Atlanta are off to a decent start this year, too. He's a guy that I think very highly of. And he was absolutely fantastic. Scored another one in this game from a ridiculous angle into the side netting. What a great player. We can have our questions about the defending in this league and goalkeeping and stuff, but there are some really fun attacking players that are worth your time in this league right now. And he's among them, near the top of the list for me.
Yeah. I just want to mention the game that I kind of focused on from the weekend was Inter Miami losing their first game of 2024 to CF Montreal.
It doesn't count though, because Messi didn't play.
And Suarez didn't start. So just one of those games, again, I'll say it, 3-2, one of those games where I'm not sure what I'm watching is football. And it's just because I watched what I watched earlier in the day, but this was just insane. After 11 minutes, Drake Callender comes running out of his goal. It was bad.
That was not a good look. Ooh, for those of us who have been championing him as
new. Completely misses the ball, and then the Montreal attacker goes round two defenders and then doesn't get a chance to hit it into the empty net. It gets blocked, goes out for a corner, Montreal score. There's a disallowed Jordi Alba goal, which I'm not sure should have been flagged. I think he was onside. And then there's a long ball, Inter Miami's center back just completely misses. Like, why is he the only one there? There's this long ball and he gets caught under it. And then the Montreal attacker is in behind him. Like, my brain was fried. Like, there was nothing close to compact, normal, tactical anything in this game. Inter are down 1-0 at halftime. Campagna equalizes on 70 minutes. He started ahead of Suarez. Montreal equalize almost immediately after that. Then they go 3-1 up. Then Jordi Alba scores. Like, a legit worldie.
What a goal.
Absolute
yeah.
beaut. Suarez hits the bar. It's meant to be a corner. It's not given. Miami take their first L of 2024. Madness. Absolute madness. Also, I saw a video of Suarez walking into the stadium before the game. And the way he walks is the way I walk. And that's a man with knees that ain't going to last the season. No wonder he didn't start.
Yeah, it's something that that they're going to have to manage. But it was one of those games with Miami where it does show that they are continuing to be dangerous till the end. Like it's
I mad game. Absolutely mad game.
Yeah. That's about all I got, JJ.
That's everything I've got. I'm one of those people that says, boy, what a weekend I've had. You know what? I need a weekend just to get over the weekend. God.
We'll have another one of these later this week, as this is a Champions League week and a big one at that. I know the one that I will be keenly focused on, Arsenal trying to turn around a 1-0 deficit against Porto. And I already see Martin Odegaard talking about how Arsenal will be ready for their gamesmanship. I think Arsenal prepared for a whole lot of time wasting in that one, which would stand to reason. We'll see how that goes. And Arsenal, you know, for whatever their form has been lately, the one slip up was that defeat at Porto where they were terrible.
And I still think Arsenal will go through in this. Yeah,
it would surprise. I still would give them the advantage as well. Yeah. I think one goal should definitely be enough for them to turn around. But Porto are not a slouch, so it should be interesting. This will be a fun midweek Champions League slate, and we will have all the reaction to that.
I'm going
to
end this pod on a note, a note of sourness for me. I don't know how you feel about it. ESPN reporting that a two-time Pro Bowl running back Saquon Barkley agrees to a 3-year, $37.75 million deal to the Eagles.
Really?
Yep. Shefty. I am sickened.
I just see the Eagles just added Bryce Huff to. Oh, JJ, we got to end this.
My first act as an American is to burn my Saquon Barkley jersey.
You probably should do that. Yeah, my phone has gone crazy and I wasn't paying attention as to why. Yeah, I got to end this because there are things happening right now on NFL free agency that require my attention. Holy cow.
You're not the commissioner. Shut up.
I have to ratify all of these signings. JJ, I enjoy this immensely. Hey, to you I say.
Check you later, Saquon.
I'll see ya.
Bye.
Catch you outside.
You've been listening to the Caught Offside Soccer Podcast.
Small details are big surfaces. Tight corners are odd shapes. Flat, rounded, textured, or tall. Whatever your next project, there's a spray paint pattern that's just right. Because Rust-Oleum's new Custom Spray 5-in-1 gives you control with 5 different spray patterns. So you can tackle nooks, crannies, edges, and curves without worrying about drips, runs, uneven coverage, or anything else. Custom Spray 5-in-1. Only from Rust-Oleum.
This message comes from BOF sponsor eBay. You'll know real when you get it. It'll say eBay Authenticity Guarantee. And you'll feel it. Maybe it's a head-turning handbag, a watch that says it all, jewelry that makes you look like the gem, or sneakers and streetwear so fresh every step feels fly. eBay gets it. So look for the blue check mark next to that thing you love and be confident that every inch, stitch, sole, and logo is checked by experts. With eBay Authenticity Guarantee, you can trust that feeling of real is always in reach. Ensure your next purchase is the real deal. Visit ebay.com for terms.
Hi, this is Craig Robinson from Ways to Win. And support for this podcast comes from Invesco QQQ, the official ETF of the NCAA. Invesco QQQ is proud to sponsor this episode and even prouder to provide access to innovation for the last 25 years. Basketball has had innovations over the years, too. We're seeing the game played in new ways every day. Learn more at Invesco.com/QQQ. Let's rethink possibility. Invesco Distributors, Inc.